Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 890. This episode brought to you by Marvel Puzzle Quest. Just in time for the digital release of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, Yondu will be floating into Marvel Puzzle Quest, so you can recruit him and you can whistle while you work your way through the galaxy, through hordes of supervillains in the latest Guardians of the Galaxy event. You can join forces with Star-Lord, Drax, Groot, build your ultimate dream team of superheroes, all from the Marvel Universe. You can download Marvel Puzzle Quest today on Google Play, iTunes, Amazon App Store, and you can compete in weekly PvP tournaments, form an alliance with your friends, take on deadly enemies and ever-changing story events, and also, help support someone that I adore, Mr. Michael Rooker. I'm Mary Poppins, y'all! I love that guy. So much fun. I'm so glad. He was so good in that movie, Katie Levine.
He was.
He was so good.
He was great.
Why can't he should get nominated for that? It was a beautiful performance. But they never nominate, the Academy looks like superhero movies and they just don't think of them as
Yeah, but they are getting better. Maybe they'll start to realize that.
In that movie. It was such a beautifully layered performance. He's he basically was a villain but you love him and he's not a, it's so fucking good.
Start the campaign.
I'm going to start the campaign. Marvel Puzzle Quest is available on all those platforms. Or you can go to Nerdist.com/MPQ. What do you got on the cork board?
So I got something kind of cool. A couple weeks ago, I went to an event that they had at the LA Public Library that was called the Wilshire Slides 1978 to 1979. And back in 1978 and 1979, this woman, Marlene Lasky, and her daughter, Annie, they really liked the architecture in LA back then.
Okay.
And so they went down Wilshire all the way from downtown to Santa Monica and just took pictures of the different buildings and all the different signage and all that stuff. And so the last couple of years, Annie and her daughter now have been going through all the photos and putting them together. They made a book out of it. And then they had this lecture at the library all about these slides. So if you live in LA, if you've lived there for a while, it's actually really interesting.
Well, Wilshire is such a main artery.
Yeah.
That carves through so many different neighborhoods and so many different things. You have Miracle Mile,
yeah.
But then you have, you start getting into Koreatown,
yeah.
And then you have downtown, and then you have Santa Monica.
On the other side, yeah. I mean, there were so many old buildings and old stores, and it was just really interesting to see. So if you're interested, you can go to photos.lapl.org, keyword Wilshire, photographer Lasky, that's Lasky, or they're selling a book on Amazon called The Wilshire Slides 1978 to 1979. But if you're interested in architecture or the history of Los Angeles, I highly recommend it.
It really is looking at the stratified layers of the city.
And the billboards were great.
Fantastic.
Oh my God. Yeah, it was awesome.
Excellent. You can send your event to events at nerdist.com. You got another one?
Shit, sorry. One more thing. This is actually from Alpha from Nerdist.
Yep.
Short films oftentimes don't get the exposure they deserve, but Alpha, the membership service from Nerdist and Geek & Sundry, is here to solve that with our new series, Short Ends, hosted by Andre Gower and Ryan Lambert, the duo who grew up in the horror comedy cult film The Monster Squad. It celebrates short films by watching them and exploring the process behind them. You can check it out and sign up for your free trial at projectalpha.com.
Excellent. Thanks, Katie Levine. This episode is James Vanderbeek, whom I've known for 20 years. We did Politically Incorrect together in like 1997 or 98 or something like that. And now James and his wife Kimberly are dear friends of my wife and me. We're just fancy couple friends, although they have four kids. We have zero kids. We have a cat. But they're such great parents. And I get, you know, they were here and Kimberly took a picture of, because I have this Yoda backpack that's sitting up on my shelf in the dressing room. And she took a picture of it. And she said, oh, my daughter is really into Yoda right now. And I go, how old is she? And she goes, 7. I go, please give this to her. Because my Yoda backpack was just sitting up on the shelf. Not, you know, I mean, like, I enjoyed looking at it up there, but he wasn't getting used.
Yeah, so like he's, the ones from, like, where it looks like Yoda's on your back.
Yeah. But he's got a little pouch in there. Yeah. Like, he needs to be on a Padawan's back teaching them the ways of the Force. So they took it and they gave it to her, and then he just posted a picture, and it's so, it looks so adorable. I'm so happy.
I was
so happy that Yoda went to the right home. It was such a great, it was fortuitous. It was meant, the Force directed it that way, and I'm so glad that it worked out that way. But I love James. He is just such a sweet, wonderful, brilliant guy. He's promoting What Would Diplo Do, which is premiering August 3rd, which is the day the podcast is actually going up. It's 10 p.m. on Viceland, and we talk about it, but it's basically a fictionalized account of – he plays Diplo. He plays DJ Diplo, and I'm really excited because James was – like, he wrote on the show and, like, was a creator and showrunner and did all the stuff. So it wasn't just an acting project. This is a real passion project about a community that he – loves. So I'm very excited for him. This episode also brought to you by Stamps.com. Stamps.com, in case you haven't been listening to almost 900 episodes of the Nerdist podcast, allows you to buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, package, class of mail. Now, you might think, well, why is that important? Well, because it will save so much time and energy in your life from it, you know, and also make you look more professional. Like, rather than just licking a stamp and smacking on a thing, you're going to print out the exact post. Just going to be a printout.
Especially if you have, like, your own business. You know, I feel like a lot of people with their own businesses at home would really love this and save so much time and effort.
Absolutely. You click, you print, you mail, you're done. It never closes. You can print postage for letters or packages 24/7. They're going to send you a digital scale. So here's the deal, all right? You're going to go to stamps.com. You're going to click the microphone at the top of the homepage and then just type in Nerdist. And then you're going to enjoy Stamps.com with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus a digital scale and postage without any long-term commitments. So go to Stamps.com, enter the promo code Nerdist. Never go to the post office again.
And enjoy your freedom.
Enjoy your freedom. Enjoy your burrito. Well, now it's weird to say enjoy your burrito at the top of a podcast. So the podcast is not over. It's just getting started. Here's Nerdist podcast number 890 with the wonderful James Vanderbeek. Katie. Yeah.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Dawson's much, but I can't not bring it up.
Oh, dude.
Because then people will be like, how come you didn't bring up? And I'm like, I know.
You're
fucking
fan.
You know what's so funny is you listen to, when people listen to stuff and they'll go, really surprised you didn't mention it. And I always write back and go, well, you'll have to somehow learn how to move on from here because it didn't happen.
I think that's why Google was invented.
Yeah, exactly. If you really want information
about the thing you've been answering questions for the last 15 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know what's so funny is that I still, like, when I have to do these radio tours, people are like, singled out, huh? And I'm like, wow, really? You know, but they still just, you know, they still just.
Well, it's an interesting thing because, like, people, when you do something, people have their own relationship to it.
Of course.
So, like, when you make it, it no longer belongs to you. It belongs to whoever watches it, and they have their own, like, thing. So you really can't dictate. Any effort to try to really, like, get in and manipulate that, I always feel like is foolhardy.
Yeah. And also, sometimes I would feel, if it's the only thing someone asks me about, I always be like, you know, I've done like 50 other things, right? You know, I've done like, and you sort of like, my own ego kind of always felt weird about it. And I would have to be like, yeah, but, you know, like At Midnight's a show that, you know, and I was like, oh, yeah, you know, but did you fuck Jenny McCarthy? I'm like, okay. You know, come on.
Yeah, yeah, the ego will kind of bite at you a little bit or just like nip at your heels when it comes to that kind of stuff. But I feel like there's a moment, I don't know when, like a couple years ago, where I just kind of went like, eh. You know, like it is, but it, the only, like when it's a fan, then it's always okay. Like
right.
If it's somebody on the street like, oh, hey, I always wanted to ask you. The answer to that is like, yes, whatever
right.
you want to ask all the time. Mm-hmm. It's when you're doing press to promote something that is actually paying the bills.
Right.
And like, you know, you only have a limited amount of time and they want to ask about something that hasn't paid your bills in
and
like
you
15
and
years.
And you get to promote the thing that you were there to
yeah,
promote.
It's like, yo, I got four kids, man. I got to, they apparently got to eat. So we got to.
I think maybe about 15 or 16 years ago, maybe more, I was doing a thing and Barry Williams was there, Greg Brady.
Oh, wow.
And I complained about a very similar thing. And then he just kind of went in, his eyes just sort of glazed over, and he listed like 10 answers that he has to answer all the time. The dog ran away. Cousin Oliver was only there for a season. We never hooked up. And I was like, holy shit, your life for like the past 3 decades
yeah.
has been, you know, has been that. Or like,
that's really funny.
I was always impressed by, you know, I'm so sad that Adam West passed away. He was such a lovely man, but he took it so much in stride and never seemed like, you know, when people would hit him with the Batman stuff, he just,
yeah.
he somehow managed to make peace with it, embrace it and be like, hey, this is a really special thing.
Do you think
thing.
He was always like that? Or do you think he must have had a process?
Who knows?
I feel like everybody has to have a process. And when you like, then you're finally cool with it.
Right. I mean, yeah. maybe in the beginning, I'm sure it was especially at the time when you're making that show and then it goes into syndication, which is still a relatively new thing at
yeah.
that point. And then that's all people talk about. And you're like, no, man, it's the 70s. I got other shit to do. And people are like, hey, it's Batman. You know, I'm sure that's not fun.
Right.
When you want to get other work and you become typecast in that way.
Yeah. But the weird thing is now, because media is so fragmented and everybody's got their own lane, everybody's got their own little like entertainment pool that their algorithm
right.
steers them towards. A lot of times when people come up to me and they're like, I'm sure you get asked this all the time, but, and it's usually one of like 5 different questions from like 5 different projects.
Right.
So they just assume that I'm always getting asked that Varsity Blues question
right.
or that Rules of Attraction question, or I know you get tired of this, but I love Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 20. And you're like, no, I never get tired of that actually. But it's just interesting. People kind of know you from what they know you from.
Right.
And, you know, people can assume it's one thing, but it's often like my experience has been it's actually a bunch of different things.
Yeah, and also it sort of help you look back and go, wow, I've actually done a lot of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I had a moment on this latest project where I realized I could say that I've been doing this for a quarter century.
Yeah, I know.
You
know,
I was like,
that's a bummer. That's
dude,
a bummer.
I'm old.
I know. I know. There was a yeah. I know. I know exactly what someone just did a story with me and it was about being in comedy for 25 years. I'm like,
yeah.
my career could get really great insurance rates now because it finally hit 25. Like that really,
if only there was such a thing as
gut.
Tenure, man.
We'd yeah, be, exactly. We'd be, we'd now you can't be fired from
golden.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're in it. No, you're in it. But I also loved, I love that you also try weird, fun stuff because I think the Power Rangers thing was awesome.
Oh, thank you.
That Power Rangers thing
thank
was
you.
So – and we rallied so hard when they pulled it down, when Saban pulled it down. Like,
God
don't they fucking know
that.
This is going to make people more interested in the thing.
God bless you for that. I love that. Yeah, that was a crazy, fun thing. I had dinner with Adi Shankar, who's a friend of mine, and I was like, so what are you up to? He's like, dude, I'm doing a totally dark, hard R take. On the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. I was like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. I'm totally in. Is there a script? He's like, would you be a part of it? I'm like, yeah, send me the script. So he sent me the script and I looked at it. I was like, would you like, do you want notes? He's like, yeah. What do you think? Do you want to meet with Joseph? I said, yeah. So I sat down with Joseph Kahn, who's a genius and a visual like virtuoso. And Joseph was like, yeah, do you have thoughts? You can just rewrite your dialogue. Let me just send you the file. So it's like, you know, open source generation. Like, let me just send you the FDX file. And so he did, and I sat down, and originally there was like some narration, and there was all the vignettes were there. Like, all the little Easter eggs were there. Those were not me. But I was like, what if I just had the interrogation drive the narrative, and I rearranged some of the vignettes? And I did this rewrite, and I thought, this would be fun because this would be like a practice for like a studio polish.
Right.
And I just had a lot of fun with it, and I sent it to Joseph. And then a week later, I got an email. This is great. Let's shoot this. I was like,
wait a minute. That never happens.
Especially when you're not, when you're used to working in a business where everything takes a year and a half to even kind of get off the ground.
Forever. And there are always notes and there are always changes and there are always a compromise in the middle that's not really what anybody wants. But this was – we just did it for free for shits and giggles. And Joseph was like, yeah, let's shoot it. So I wrote a sword fight in there because I wanted a sword fight. And it's funny because I've been wanting to get into more like kind of stunts and fight and, you know, kind of – build up that part of my resume. And so I wanted to go to this 8711 place that I'd heard about.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's the really crazy intense. You have to be invited to...
Yeah, it's like a dojo and it's like...
Where Keanu Reeves like trained, right?
Yeah, it's where it's Keanu's stunt double from The Matrix and his partner. And they started this in this like hangar near like LAX somewhere. And people just, stunt guys just come in and it's like the best athletes in the world and they're training. And I'd wanted to like get in there. And so I do this rewrite just as like on a lark, like whatever. And Joseph goes, would you mind going to this place called 8711? You don't have to go many times. I'm like, dude, I'm there every day. So I showed up every day, and now they can't get rid of me.
That's fantastic. Now so, you're part of it. Now you're part of the
crew.
Like
part of it. And every time I do a thing that has stunts, I'll like write in ninjas. I'm like, oh, yeah, I got it. I'll like put some ninjas in here. And then I'll call the guys, and I'll get them work. And it's just like it's been a fun – way to keep in shape, and I love it.
I think it was kind of a compliment. I'm actually surprised that they were able to take it down because I'm sure – they were able to block it using the IP argument, but then there's also the other argument of like satire and freedom of expression and being able to add sort of your own commentary to stuff. But I think there's a weird compliment in there somewhere where they were probably like, shit, I don't know if we're going to make anything this cool. You know, I mean, where they didn't want it to, you know, it's like it would be difficult for them to release their movie and people go, yeah, but the fucking YouTube thing was a million times cooler than anything, you know, that could ever get done.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like the intention. Like, I don't want to shit on anybody's IP devalue it. But yeah, I mean, the fact that they felt that threatened was kind of odd. But I also, I don't know, I tried to understand it through the prism of like Saban's point of view. Like, this older guy did not grow up with the internet.
Right.
And he buys this thing that makes him billions of dollars.
Right.
And now somebody's making something that looks like a movie and putting it out for free and it's not on brand for me. No. Take it down.
And also, I mean, listen, I don't know anything about the guy. Maybe if we're giving him a little bit of slack, maybe it could be like, oh, my thing is supposed to be for kids. This is not for kids.
Yes.
It challenges the tone of this brand that I made.
Yeah, and I know the guy who wrote the movie that they subsequently made. He was like the last guy to come in and do the rewrite. And it was definitely like kids, kids, kids.
Right.
Like make it young.
Now, I know I've talked to you about this before, but do you actually remember when we did Politically Incorrect together?
I do.
Do you remember? It was like 1996 or something. I think it was the first time I was on.
It had to have been after 98.
90, okay.
Yeah.
Then it wasn't the first time I was on, but we did.
I do remember doing it with you because I remember maybe you were much rounder then.
I was rounder. Yeah, I was much rounder.
There was a lot more of you.
There was much more of me.
I feel like.
You know, jackets were bigger, cuts were bigger, hair was floppier.
Oh, man. It was a different time. I don't think we're ever going to have a flashback to that time fashion wise. You know what I mean? Like, there's a time in the 90s when everybody was like pegging their pants and like wearing like bell bottoms. No way. But then that totally came back. And
yeah.
I don't think we're ever going to go back to like, I'm a 40, but I'm going to wear a 44 jacket.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
I don't super think that, baggy.
Like neon shirts and baggy clothes. Like,
I heard frosted tips are coming back.
Frosted tips. You know what's hilarious about frosted tips? I know so many writers who, when they got their first like big gig, got frosted tips. I know like four or five television writers who, the first time they became a showrunner, the first time they sold a movie, all of a sudden they had frosted tips.
You know,
it was like the thing to do.
Yes, it is the male equivalent of French tip nails, where it's like, this is what classy people do. You know, exactly. Like it's what classy people do. P.S. it's not. So don't run out and get frosted tips. Please don't get frosted
just
tips.
Just don't do it. Just
did you ever frost the...
No, that 90s hair was all me, except after I did Varsity Blues, because I dyed it black for that, and then
right.
I had to dye it blonde again for Dawson's Creek, and then
it got
off. Was like a 10-hour process that left my skull bleeding and like my hair like straw, and it was really bad.
So when I saw you at the Dodger game,
mm-hmm.
it was really fun to see you with your kids, because you basically managed to, and you know, this is something I'm really interested in, because you know, Lydia and I are starting to have the kid conversation.
Yeah.
But you were able to have a conversation and your limbs operated independently of your of your head, because you essentially were the equivalent of like a cat tree.
Yes.
And so you had like one child on your leg and another one you were just kind of was just kind of dangling on your arm, and the kids were completely engaged and entertained, and somehow you were able to separate your body from your brain at that point and just have a regular conversation while knowing exactly how to balance all of that. Was that natural, or did you have to learn how to do that?
That just comes with practice. That comes when you have four kids under six.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
We had four kids under five at one point. Yeah.
How do you do it?
I'm addressing your wife, Kimberly, right now.
She's a superwoman. I really don't know how she's done it.
I mean, so because what's amazing to me is like, so how do you get to three and go, let's do four? Like, is it the process of like, you know, like the like getting like raising a baby and turning it into a human, or is it just like we just like as many little feet running around the house as possible?
I think we're still trying to figure out what's causing it. I don't know. We've always just kind of left it open. I don't know. We've really just been – just felt really blessed every time we have one. And I don't know. I just feel like if a soul wants in, who are we to stop it?
And they all have, I would imagine, their own very, very distinct personalities.
Oh, completely. Same ingredients, same recipe, and they all come out completely different. And they're different even in utero. Like the way they move in the womb is the way they move when they come out of the womb, and they're all different. They like people, you know. People say, "Oh, are you proud? Do you see things of yourself in them? Do you see little things that oh, that's me?" And I feel like we just won like the cosmic lottery with each of them. You know, I feel like it's like a cosmic adoption in some way. Like they just want to come in, and then they take some of your genes and some not, but they're completely them. All of them are completely their own thing and their own person and their own personality and their own tendencies. And it's really fascinating. You just feel grateful that like you get to be the person that gets to kind of guide them and hold them and know them, like as they come into really who they are.
God, this just makes me think I'm a horribly evil person, because all I can think of is just like, oh my God, stress all day long. I'm just going to have to worry about keeping them from killing themselves somehow.
Of course. But that's how I was before I had kids.
Okay.
Like I would go over to somebody's house. I remember I was with Kimberly and we went to see her mom's boss, and they had this kid. This little, like, I don't know, he was walking, so he must have been, like, you know, one and a half or two. And we saw him, and he was cute, and all I could think was, I can't wait to get the fuck out of here. Like, what do you do with that thing? Like, that thing lives here. Like, it's got to go to bed, it's got to eat, it's got to wake up in the morning, it's probably going to wake up in the middle of the night. Like, what do you do with that all day? And I knew I wanted kids, I was always that guy, but there was just that thing of, like, well, God, I'm going to have to get up in the middle of the night. I'm going to have to change diapers. I'm going to have to not watch the football game. I'm going to have to do all these things. And for me, the second I met my daughter, I mean, like the second she came out, all of that reversed. And it was just, I am going to change that diaper. That's what I want to do the most. Nothing. Football game is no longer important at all. That's everything she needs. That's my priority. Like I always describe it as, like, before I had kids, I was in a sea, and there are all these priorities, like in the waves, like bobbing up at any given time, something was more important. And the second I had kids, it was like a triangle. And at the top of that were like my wife and my kid.
Right.
And everything was just existed to support that. And it wasn't like, I did become a better version of myself than who I was before, but it wasn't because I was good. It was just that was like the internal reaction. So that's what I say to people before they have kids and they're thinking about, God, I'm going to have to do all that. It's like, yeah, totally natural. Like that's how you're going to feel.
All right, good.
Until you meet them, and then there will be nothing more important in your life.
Yeah, because I have met other parents who they adore their kids and they go, yeah, I used to think I love my kids. I think everyone else's kids are shitty, but yeah. I love my own kids, you know, because it's like, because I always said I did joke in my act about how you only ever notice kids in public when they're being dicks.
Yes.
It's like you don't notice the ones who are quiet and being really cool and not and, yeah. and being sweet. Yeah. It's just like the kid who shits up his own back and grabs guacamole and throws it on the ground and like yeah. flips the table. And
with
like,
snot running down his face.
Yeah, exactly.
And
you're like, Jesus Christ.
Get the fuck away from my kid with your snotty ass face. I do not want you touching my – yeah.
Yeah.
there's a little bit of that. And listen, I mean, it's not like, you know, our house is just – you know, yoga music and calmness all the time. Like, it gets crazy. It gets insane. And there are times when you just look at your partner and you're like, oh my God, what are we doing?
Well, you probably just put out one fire and there's potentially three more fires to put out.
There's a lot. There's always a lot going on. I always call it just barely contained chaos glued together by moments of pure bliss.
Right.
Like, the bliss has to be something that you've never experienced before, because the other side of it is so insanely ridiculous. And to try to reason, like, especially to work like a 14-hour day on set and come back and like have to convince four little humans to brush their teeth.
Right.
It's like, come on. Yeah, do you want to brush your teeth? You know, you got to get the sugar buggies out. Come on. Oh, hey, toothpaste is falling. You're going to catch it. Spider-Man, you're going to catch a toothpaste. Like, it takes so much energy to just do those things. That you really have to love it.
See, that's really sweet. I just wonder if I'm going to be like, brush your teeth because they'll fall out and no one will hire you for anything. You know what I mean?
Maybe I'm going to try that tonight.
You'll
because
never get a job.
I probably should. Nobody's going to hire you with no teeth. Not in this town, kid. You better brush them.
Well, it's not. I've been sort of picking at people who have kids and that I know are really good parents, because I'm just really trying to understand more of the, because it's especially, did you have brothers or sisters?
I did, yeah.
Oh, see, that helps a lot, because I didn't. And so
okay.
When you're an only child, then you're so used to like, everything about me is important. Why do I need to focus on it? But when you have siblings, you at least have some understanding of how to operate within a system where you're not the most important thing.
Yeah. I also think it also helps to have figured out your relationship with your parents, whether good or bad, or, you know, everybody's got stuff, but just to kind of have explored that to a degree where you feel like you have a grasp on what's important, what you need, what you needed, and what you want to do for your kid. I think
right.
that's – there is one piece of unsolicited advice that I give in terms of the actual birthing process that I give people.
Okay.
Which is take the first hour after the kid is born for just the three of you. It's more life than you've ever experienced. It's more than you've ever gotten the chance to hold in your head and your heart and your soul. And all of that has to expand because you've never experienced anything like this. And your tendency, especially as a man, is to want to be, okay, what am I doing? I got to get the cord blood thing figured out. I got to call this. I got to call this person. I got to let them know. And I would advise to just, for the first hour, just spend time with the three of them and let it wash over you. Because it is the most delicious hour of life. And there's no way to explain it. There's no way to prep somebody for it. It's just something that happens. So, you know, there's nobody that you have to call in that first hour. And in fact, if you call them after that first hour, you'll be able to have a better conversation with
right.
your parents or your uncle or your best friend or whoever you really want to share this with. Do it after that first hour. And the baby doesn't need to be washed right away or weighed right away. You know, you healthy, happy, everything's good. You can just like, they warm up best on mom anyway.
Right.
And they'll probably want to suckle a little bit. So just like, just do that. And some hospitals actually respect it. They call it the golden hour. And they kind of respect that space. Everybody walks out of the room and they just let these three people experience this thing that is really kind of indescribable.
Well, that is a good piece of advice. I'm going to pretend like, when it happens, that it was my idea.
You should. You totally should, dude.
You know what? Let's just take an hour.
Hey, Lydia, I got this.
Let's have a golden hour. Yeah. I'm going to turn the phone off.
You just and make I, sure she understands the hour part. Because then a golden what?
And then I'll run into you and be like, hey, did you do the golden hour? Oh, the thing I told you about? Yeah. Yeah, we did it. It was great. You should try it sometime. I just want to be able to take some – I'll have to be able to steal some credit somewhere for, you know, being an intuitively smart parent.
But you are. That's the thing. You really are. Like, you're a good dude and that comes through. Like, you really – you just kind of reach down to like the best of you, I feel like, because you care about this thing that came in your life and you want to do well by it. And so it just kind of forces you to overcome certain things and to realize your own garbage. Like your own garbage just gets thrown in your face immediately. and kids also, it's like one of those zombie movies where like anything that's used against the zombies, they then use against you
sure.
immediately. Like I realized that the first time my kid wagged his finger at me. he was like, no, daddy. And like all of a sudden he's pointing his finger. I'm like, fuck, I'm supposed to do that. You can't. Wow. I really do have to figure out a way to communicate with you. I can't just order you what to do.
Oh, yeah.
You got to really
They're just absorbing all the time.
They're absorbing it all the time. And they all, at least my kids, all want to use the same phrases back at me and the same expression.
Where did my kid learn to say fuck nut?
Well, Olivia swore for the first time she swore, she was like, I want to say she was like three. I was like running around, like trying to multitask. And she goes, daddy, you getting shit done?
Yeah. Well, yeah, he is. Your daddy is getting shit done.
Like, so
yeah.
I looked at her. I said, the only thing you can say, which is, I said, yes, honey, daddy's working like a motherfucker.
I mean, I feel like we have to, I mean, it's good to teach kids about rules of decorum, but I think the language thing is like, it's 2017. You know, it's like, the kids are gonna get it. They're gonna get it on the internet. They're gonna get it from other kids at school.
Yeah.
And you know, it's, and then I feel like the more mystical you make it, the more they're gonna want to do it. So I was like,
I would have argued against you had my wife, who is the face of an angel, also not have the mouth of a truck driver. She floats when she walks across a room. She is beautiful and elegant in every way except one, which is she curses all the time.
Good for you, Kimberly. Good for you.
And not just in a petite way. And like she drops something and goes, shit, fuck, motherfucker. And yep. I'm like with all of our kids in the room. And I will say, our kids don't swear. They don't curse. It's so weird. They really don't. That time that Olivia said that was basically like the only time she's ever used
that's
that
incredible.
Word.
Yeah, Lydia has some good swear strings too.
Yeah,
yeah, she has really good swear strings. Yeah. And you don't really expect it. I when I first met her and having it, I was like, whoa, this is awesome. You know, because yeah. I was terrified I was gonna be the one who was like, I'm so sorry for the way that I am and speak. It's just the way, you know. But she's So I'm excited about that part of it.
Yeah.
And also, it's just funny to hear a tiny voice say a horrible word. It's just kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Motherfucker. Come on.
Yeah.
So when my
kid says Jesus all the time now. I'm like, Joshua, you can't say Jesus. Why not? Like where do you go?
High-level concept.
How do you explain Jesus to a kid?
How do you explain that to a kid? How do you explain the nuance of when it's acceptable and not acceptable for most people to hear it and how to judge, you know, the myriad of reactions that you might get. But I think those are the kind of things where you're like, well, use it and see what happens. And then that's how you learn. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I guess that how else do you learn other than,
I guess, I mean, he must have heard it from somebody else. Cause it's not something that I say on a regular basis, but yeah. You're like, where do you go? Okay. There was a really nice man who was killed, but it's because you're a sinner.
Yeah, exactly.
You
should use it this way, but not this way. Sometimes it's a swear, but sometimes it's a guy.
It's a holy guy, and he's dead. Been dead a long time. Yeah.
I have a very distinct memory of being dropped off from my carpool in probably no more than fourth grade. And I was getting out of the car. My mom was standing at the door. So I was in between the car full of someone's mom and a bunch of kids. And I dropped my backpack. And I think what came out of my mouth was, you jerk off. And I think in my head, I just thought that meant jerk.
Yeah.
And I just, I saw my mom's expression and immediately understood like, oh, I think I just stepped on an ornament.
Yeah.
A Christmas ornament. And then the mother, and she was just looking at the mother in the car and she was like, where did you learn? And I don't remember where I learned it. I was like, oh, it just means like a jerk, you know?
Yeah.
And I would discover what a really amazing thing it actually means. but at the time, I just
didn't. It's a very sacred thing.
I didn't really understand. And I don't remember where I heard it. I think you just, when your brain is forming, it just absorbs the environment and then things just come out. And that's how you learn how to engage with the world.
I had the same experience with douchebag. I just thought douchebag. What a great word. Hey, douchebag. I was very young and was like, I could see my parents both freeze and like tense up. Like, you shouldn't say that word. I'm like, why not? What is it? It's just a douchebag.
Right.
And like, my dad just kind of walking out of the room and my mother like explaining, like trying to explain the process of feminine hygiene.
It's very difficult to, but it's a colloquialism for something else. And even then, yeah, it's very difficult to, the fact that we get so hung up on language when language is just really a tool. And it's like, are we not evolved enough that these types of words shouldn't really mean it? Like, is it more just because people like to have, you know, degrees of rules on things of like, you can't do this if you want to fit in polite society? Like, it just feels so Victorian, you know, society.
And it's getting worse too with the political correctness. You know what I was realizing the other day is that like artists now, comedians are being held to some crazy weird Puritan standard of like political correctness, but world leaders are not.
Right.
You know, like, oh, he's a president. He's got a job to do. It's all right if he, you know, grabs a little pussy here and there.
Right.
But like, you know, somebody makes a joke about it and all of a sudden they're excoriated by like any kind of political. It's just such a weird thing.
A lot of that is
time.
Ego, though. People love to be offended by things because it is empowering to be offended by things.
Self-righteousness.
And it also gets
very,
you attention. Yeah. If someone goes, I am so offended, everyone goes, oh my God, what happened? Are you okay? You know, like,
yep.
It really, I would say, unfortunately, not all, but some of the I'm so offended comes from, is much more about ego than a lot of people would be willing to admit, because 100%. it does get you attention. Now,
and it's also like energetic junk food.
It gives
you a rush, it gives you a quick bolt of energy.
Afterwards. It gets gray because there are, you know, certain things that do become just flat out hate speech. We're like, okay, well, that's not okay.
Of course. But if it's meant to wound, if it's meant to, you know, be offensive, if it's like used in a, like to beat somebody over the head or try to make them feel bad about themselves.
Yeah, it's so strange that we get so hung up on the actual word and just the word, like just words, yeah, just words, it's themselves, and not like, well, what is the context? What is the nuance? What was the person trying to accomplish? Was it this? Was it that? I mean, like, that's a whole process. It takes a lot of thought to, you know, to put something under a microscope each time. So I think it's easier just to go, you know, oh, well, fuck that. You know, everyone, I think, really wants, because I think there's just so much information to process at all times. They just want like a yes or no button for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, this is okay. No, that is not okay. And anything that requires any type of depth or understanding or anything is just, it's just too much energy.
It's more than 140 characters, bro.
It's more than 140 characters.
Yeah.
More than 140 characters. Yeah. I wanted to dig in a little bit and figure out, because with the Viceland show that you worked on, the show about Diplo.
Yeah.
You were so heavily involved in that.
Yeah.
That how are you that heavily involved in something but still manage to, you know, make sure that you're keeping your home life balanced? So just if you can just talk a little bit about the Diplo show.
Yeah.
And then I would love to understand how you're able to balance that.
it's been a new balancing act. So this Diplo thing, Diplo's management last year around June or July was putting together a promo video for the Mad Decent Block Party tour.
Uh-huh.
And they had very wisely and astutely picked out Brandon Dermer, this young director, out of the sea of young up-and-coming music video directors. And they said, you know, do you have an idea for this promo? And Brandon's idea was, you know what? What if we have James Vanderbeek play Diplo in like a Dollar Shave Club type vibe? And they said, sure. Do you know him? He's like, nope. And they're like, well, you know, we can reach out. And as it had happened, I had kind of flagged Diplo as a kind of a genius like a couple years back. So when the offer came in, I was like, oh, well, you know, let me think about it. And so I went, I checked out Brandon's reel and what he directed. He did the Dylan Francis's Not Butter video.
Okay.
Which I really was like, okay, this guy is really onto something. So I met, we did this promo. I did a little bit of a rewrite. Again, he sent me the FDX file. I was like, you open the notes? He's like, yeah, I'll send you the FDX file. Did a little rewrite in like 20 minutes, added some ninjas, as I'm prone to do.
And
I'm seeing a pattern.
I'm seeing a pattern. Like, what could I add from my childhood that would be amazing?
I'm just warming up for a lightsaber
sword
one
fighting,
day. I just want ninjas. A lightsaber one day. That's what I want.
Hey, listen, they're making a shit ton of Star Wars movies.
I know. Somewhere, I got to like pick up a lightsaber, right?
You're going to need to be in there.
So we shot it. I never thought, none of us ever thought it would be anything more than that. But it came out last July 3rd, actually. And it got a lot of press play. People really seemed to like it. And then Nick Weidenfeld at Viceland mm-hmm. came to...
I know Nick.
Yeah.
Nice guy. Really sweet guy.
Yeah, really sweet guy. And saw it before any of us did and said, hey, where are you taking this? And we're like, what? He's like, this show. We're like, it's not a show. It's just a one-off. He said, no, this is a series. And I was like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. He's like, I'll green light it. You can, restrain the series for Viceland. I was like, well, let me think. And I went back that night and I was like, wait a minute. Holy shit. Yeah, this is like EDM Jesus sucks at life.
Right.
And so I came back to Diplo's manager and to Brandon. And I was like, I think I know how to write this. I think I know how to run this. And if you'll let me do that, then I'll star in it. And they were like, okay. So I pitched them the whole thing. And then Brandon and I flew out to New York and pitched Spike Jones, who was like the creative director of the mm-hmm. network. And what I pitched were parables about life through the eyes of a clown in this crazy EDM world. So I hired two writers, Hal Ozan and Jordan Van Dyna. And together with Brandon, we would break everything in the room. And I'd gotten some really good advice from Mark Duplass, actually.
Oh, wow.
Who had said – I just worked for him on the HBO show Room 104.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, he'll probably feel guilted into taking some time with me to, to give me some advice on running a show. And I sat down with him. He was like, if you're only doing like 5 episodes and you can write them before you start prep, he's like, maybe it might be more efficient for you to just write them all. So do it salon style. So we would break it in the room – on the whiteboard, have these long philosophical hoity-toity conversation. Who's used that word in the last 100 years?
I think just you.
I think just me.
Yeah.
And only me. these highfalutin conversations.
These highfalutin, and someone in Kansas was like, you're not going to that hoity-toity homecoming dance.
That just came out of my mouth. And so we would break it in the room. I would wake up the next morning really early, make my coffee, sneak out before the kids got up, and write until like 11, email the script to the writer's office. They'd show up at 11. I'd just email it without even proofreading it, which was so freeing and liberating. And then we'd talk about it and we'd tear it apart and discuss. And I realized the things that would normally take me as a writer like 2 weeks to figure out, we could solve in about 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how we wrote it. And that's how I ended up show running for the first time. And, it was a little bit in terms of like how it was an experiment because Viceland doesn't have any scripted programming right now. So there was no template. They're like, as a network, they're more like a rogue band of creative people.
Right.
So their notes were always kind of crazy, experiment, keep it weird. And so each episode is like a different swing. It's a little bit different tonally. We just kind of wanted to see what we could accomplish and just try some shit. So it was in that weird, crazy open space that I would then be like, okay, got to go home. And so that I'd come back. And it's interesting. As an actor, I feel like in the beginning of my career, it was always about like, how do I get there? How do I get to the darkness? How do I get to what it is I have to accomplish? And then around like my mid to late 30s, something clicked and I realized, oh, wait a minute. Like if it exists in humanity, I can channel it.
Sure.
So it's not about me having to go there. It's all about like, how do I channel it cleanly and let it not stick to me? And that opened up a whole other like realm because I was no longer afraid of getting stuck in a place or I just wasn't afraid of anything. So I could just let it happen. And I was like a channel for all of it.
That makes sense.
Yeah,
and you're like a medium. You're like an acting medium.
It's kind of what it is. That's kind of how I look at it, really. And so that made the acting thing way more fun, and I became more fun to everybody in my life when I started to look at it that way. And then with writing, and I was like a showrunner, you're answering questions every 4 seconds about everything from what do you want this mug to look like to what should the, you know. And fortunately, I had Brandon Dermer, my director, who directed every episode, so he and I were like partners in that. So he shouldered a lot of it as well in the shot listing. And but it was weird because I felt like I was, you get in that creative space and you feel like, okay, it's great, I'm living here, I don't want to shut the door too much because I want to get back in it.
Right.
And so I was having a conversation with my wife actually just recently about like, okay, now that I've done this once, I think I have confidence that I can access that pool of like creativity. You know, I can go into that realm and get these answers and make the decisions and then step away from it. And like, you know, like a pop-up book, like just close it and then go home.
But then you'll discover new things. Like once you have a basic understanding of something, then that's where you start. That's where the discovery process starts. Yeah. 'Cause then you kind of understand what some of the rules are. So then you can start mm-hmm. getting really granular with how do you evolve and how do you make something more interesting and how do you, oh, if we did this, I guess we could do that. You know, it's like the one-upsmanship of it.
Oh, of course. And that's been like the challenge as, you know, I go into editing and going into post and VFX and sound edits and all this is to let it go in the same way that I did as an actor. Because an actor, it's easier because you show up on set, you offer a bunch of choices for director to put on a menu, and then you walk away and you let them figure out exactly what, you know,
right,
what the thing is. And then, and I learned a long time ago as an actor to just really let it go. And so if that meant not watching something that I'd done until like years later, that's just what I would do.
Right.
And this, you know, it's like, it's first time. It's like my first time writing a show. It's my first time doing a lot of things. So you want it to be good. Like you want to, and you think immediately, wow, I would really like to do this again. So I want to make sure it's the best it can be. But at the same time, it's also the first time I've done it. So, you know, it's okay if it's a little uneven. It's
well,
okay
that's good.
If it's a little, if, you know, somebody said to me, perfect is the enemy of good.
Well, that, you know, that's so funny you say that because I thought of something in the car the other day, and I want to put it on something and keep it next to my computer. Put it on a T-shirt, but the idea of it is there's no artistry in perfection.
Yeah,
and it came from the idea that when Lydia and I were, we went to Hearst Castle a few weeks ago, and we're just kind of looking at just absorbing it, and you know we like to go every once in a while looking at textures and stuff. We went to this one place that Lydia had never seen before. And the floor tiles were all perfect squares. Mm-hmm. And the director of the castle is this really wonderful woman named Mary. And she was explaining that the story was that when her great-great-grandfather saw it, he made some sort of a comment about how, oh, well, those look perfect. And the idea was that he wasn't saying it as a compliment.
Wow.
And so I was like, oh, my God, yes, of course. When something is too perfect, there's no like humanity to it. There's no artistry to it. It's too machine-like and sterile. And so like the wrinkles and the fuck ups and that, like that's where all the art lives, because those are all that's like a shared experience. You know? Like that's flaws are strengths.
Flaws are unique.
Yes, unique and special.
Yeah.
Nothing is special when everything's the same, you know?
Yes. And when you go for it, you know it works because it's worked before. There's safety in that, but it's not nearly as interesting. So I'm at the point right now where I'd almost rather swing and miss a little bit on the off chance that I connect on one of these things and it's exciting.
Yeah. And maybe it could lead you in a whole other direction that you hadn't even ever thought of before.
Yes. That's the exciting thing. That's what I realized, like my job as showrunner, and allow me to wax poetic after after having done it once, I feel like it was like maybe around 60% making decisions, getting everybody on the same page, motivating everyone. Hey, let's get excited about this idea. And then 40% on really careful watch for a better idea
right.
to pop up and facilitating an environment and a set where a better idea can come to the surface and get captured.
Right.
So even in the way we shot it, we cross shot everything. We had to move super quick because we had no time. We shot everything on 6K so we could, an over could become a single. A two shot could become, you know, a single
mm-hmm.
In post. And that was so much fun to cast based on who we cast these forces of nature. Like we got Bobby Lee.
Oh yeah,
play
of course.
A role. We have Jamar Neighbors in it. H. Michael Kroner is so funny and saves me on so many little gaps in writing. And they just come in and Dora Madison and I know I'm forgetting somebody. Oh, Dylan Francis is also in it. Dylan is amazing. I saw what Dylan was doing on Snapchat. And Dylan actually knows Diplo and knows Wes and is like part of that world, but he plays a character. He plays like this hanger-on with like the lowest IQ of any functioning human being. And to watch them, you know, sometimes a joke is structured because, you know, in a way that it needs to be said word for word. And sometimes, you know, plot needs to be conveyed. And sometimes it's important that people stick to the script, but a lot of times it's not. And so many times I watch them embody something and make it their own and sometimes come up with something completely different that was so much better. And that was, I would say, almost more rewarding than having written something, because when somebody else does something and it's unique and it's awesome, you're like, yes, that's great.
Right.
And you can have total confidence in it. When it comes through you, there's always that second guessing of like, well, I mean, it was my idea. Is it really the best one?
Right.
So,
and it's also, you also have to be careful that all the characters don't have your voice.
Oh, yeah,
and
for
so
sure.
That's where all that comes in. I'm curious to know, when you met with Spike Jonze, did he enter the room through a tiny door riding a penny farthing bike with a talking monkey on his shoulder?
Because
how I like to envision him.
I will say he's got a little tiny chihuahua that he pets that sits on his lap. While you're talking to him.
It talks. The dog talks, right?
not when I'm around.
Not when
but
you're
I
around.
Know as soon as I left the room, the dog was the one making
good meeting, Spike.
Calling the shots. Yeah, yes. Exactly.
Let's do this.
No, I love Spike.
Very hoity-toity, wasn't
such
he?
A huge fan. Well, he was quite hoity-toity. But he might do a good job. He may be fine. Yeah, man, I've loved his work for so long.
Well, yeah, I mean, just the guy is he's a visionary. Like you just the second you see his stuff, you go, oh yeah, that's not of this earth. That is a whole other realm. You couldn't teach that to someone. You couldn't force that. It's just his brain is slightly askew from the rest of humanity, and that's what comes out.
And he gives such great notes. Like at one point we just kind of pitched all the episodes to him, and he would say, "What if he said this?" And you're like, "Ooh, that's fucking amazing. That's great." Yeah, it's really fun.
Now, did he come to set, or was he involved that much?
No, he was the one who kind of greenlit it, and then he came to the writer's room after we'd written everything, and I pitched everything out, and that's where he gave his notes. And then he would give notes on cuts kind of through his assistant and, you know, his executive. But he was never on set. He's very obviously very busy and is always doing some crazy thing, like he's designing Frank Ocean's set or something.
Sure, of course.
Like he's always got these crazy projects.
So building an underwater habitat for the future of humanity, I'm sure. Is there are you having to explain, because I imagine you've probably done a lot of junket stuff and a lot of interviews and stuff, has anyone been like, electric dance music, James, what is that about? Can you explain to me?
Yeah, every once in a while I'm
EDM.
I'm asked to talk about it.
What is EMD? No.
Especially like my parents and my parents' friends. It's almost like when I was first on the WB and people would be like, so are you working? And I was like, yes, I'm on a show. Oh, what's it called? Well, I'm the title character. Oh, is it like a cable access thing? No, it's a real show.
On the WB. Oh, I don't think we get that.
It's a real show, Aunt Rose. I'm telling you. And it's like, well, what channel is it on? Probably channel 98, wherever you live. But it's a real show, I'm telling you. And it's almost the same kind of thing with this, because it's like, so what's your new show about? It's like, do you know who Diplo is? And you know, there's a certain age cutoff, I think. Like
right.
Above that, the answer is, Dip what?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you say, well, he's kind of like the Frank Sinatra of EDM. Do you know what EDM? And they think it's some kind of drug, and you're like,
ED Gourmet? No.
It's like, no, it's called electronic dance. Oh, yeah, I don't know any of that.
I'm not sure.
And then, of course, you can then follow it up with, well, I'm playing him. And they're super impressed.
If you don't know, you don't know, all right? Just stop asking. You're not going
to
know.
And then, of course, what's it going to be? It's on Viceland.
Yeah, you're having to – the show is about something that Aunt Rose doesn't know on a platform that Aunt Rose doesn't know by a network that Aunt Rose doesn't know. I mean, it's like – it's just a – but, you know, the interesting thing is that if you can get people like that to check it out once, they go, you know, actually,
It was really interesting. It was really I kind of liked that Lean On song. That was good. Yeah.
Did you go to like Electric Daisy Carnival or any of the?
We went to the Madison Block Party, and we actually threw me up on stage as him, and didn't tell anybody to get the footage, which was pretty amazing. And actually, the most amazing thing about it, because the footage looks like $1 bazillion, which we never could have staged. We did the same thing at the Aaron Styles show here for about 1:40. If you were at that show, it was me and not Wes. Just dancing with the dancers and running around, and you know, there's a shot of me in front of 30,000 people, everybody following my hand movements, and like,
oh wow,
which is just gold for us as a show. But the really invaluable thing at the Mad Decent Block Party was I'm standing up, and at that point I was actually behind the rig, and Wes, who's Diplo, had shown me how to make a loop and how to do all this other stuff, which he thought was so easy to do, and it's so not
right.
But I looked at this sea of people looking up and being like, move me, like make me want to throw my hands in the air. And it became abundantly clear that this is not like the energy can't stop at the person behind the turntable. He's got to like give that back.
Right.
He's got to read the crowd, figure out what they want, give it to them, then figure out what they don't know they don't want. And give that to them. And if it ever like stops and it's just like this kind of, oh yeah, I'm the best, I'm a musical god kind of thing, it's going to be a very ungratifying experience for the audience. So to understand that firsthand and see it was really interesting.
I mean, we had an EDM tent at the festival, mm-hmm. in Northern California that I made a couple of weeks ago, and it was as big as anything else at the festival. Like it is. The movement is real, and people are passionate about it. What? How would you describe? I mean, you kind of did just now, but what is it that makes an extra special? Like, what is the artistry behind it that makes an extra? Just for people who are like, oh, well, is it really that hard to like play songs on your iPod? You're like, no, you're not playing songs on
your
iPod.
Right. I mean, well, first of all, and as per Wes's instructions, we take the piss out of the whole thing. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, if you read any interviews with Diplo, he'll be like, yo, we're all so fucking cheesy. So stupid. Like, we're just, you know. But there really is artistry to it. He would probably roll his eyes if he heard me waxing so poetic about it. But, I mean, it's a show. It's like in this day and age when everybody can consume any kind of entertainment they want from the comfort of their couch by themselves, to have an event where people congregate together physically, a bunch of sweaty bodies, all experiencing the same thing together.
And becoming an organism.
Yeah, there's something to that. There's something to being around everybody else's energy, not to be too hippie about it, but like...
Hey, it's cool, man. I went to raves in the early 90s. I get it. I remember DJ Dan. I went to fucking raves and watched him spin on turntables and watched someone with an ecstasy hat walking around, exactly. Wearing a fucking Dr. Seuss hat and a clock on their neck.
That's what it is. But there's a real openness to it. Like, there's a real openness to the people that are there. There's a kind of community spirit that comes out of it. But just to watch people who are there, they're sweaty, they're tired, and then just by the music that's coming out of the speakers, they're jumping with energy they don't even have. They're going into reserves that they, you know, just were unaware of prior to that song coming on. And to watch the crowd, watch him just like play with the crowd and then bring it down and then bring it back up, and then he's got the dancers and the lights and the sand and the fog cannon and the, you know, all this other like stuff that goes along with the show. It's a really gratifying kind of adrenaline fueled experience.
And also the fortitude of people. I mean, with the EDM tent, I feel like I was across the whole area from the tent. I'm like, fuck, that's loud. And then you look inside and you see people are basically just like their fucking faces like in a speaker. Like, how are their eyes not bleeding out of their head from the intensity of the sound?
Yeah, it's an outlet. It's an outlet. And it's what was really interesting when I first – one of the reasons I kind of thought this could be a really interesting thing to explore and do like a deep dive on was just because some of what makes – some of what hits in this kind of music is vulnerability. You know, you've got, then there's a place obviously for music that is, you know, kind of aggro and like braggadocio and like, you know, I'm at this point in my life bored with people just bragging about their cars and their money. But
Well, don't forget about my big dick.
Why not?
Sorry, I'm really sorry. Well, actually.
Well, how could I forget? but like what works in a lot in like electronic music is people screaming at the top of their lungs, "Don't let me down." Like, where are you now that I need you? Like, these are real expressions of vulnerability.
And it's a raw emotional connective experience.
Yeah, and that's what connects with people. And I thought that could be a fun space to explore.
And that raw expression is really fascinating, of just throwing all of your emotions, like just being completely open and throwing all your emotions out there and not communicating with words, not communicating anything, but you're essentially communicating with sound and dance and movement.
Yeah.
And I think Lydia maybe told me that, was it at Coachella this year? One of the big festivals had like a silent EDM where everyone had headphones on.
Interesting.
So that they were all hearing the same thing. But so if you were to watch it,
it would look insane.
But it created an environment where the sound wasn't bleeding into the other acts, but it still allowed everyone to have that shared experience in one place.
It's interesting. Was it cool? Was it fun?
I don't know. She didn't go. Yeah, I don't know. But she just said, because because one of the things when you're sort of planning a festival is like, how do you make sure stuff doesn't bleed into everything else?
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that she said. I was like, I feel like that would have there'd be a tremendous amount of expense being like, here's your headphones. Now here's your headphones.
Now make sure you return them.
Don't damage these. I know where exactly. You are. I see you. You know.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but it's a crazy phenomenon. There's a line in the show. I think it's in the first episode, actually. Where Diplo was talking to Calvin Harris, and
played by Calvin Harris.
No, we were DJs play themselves. No musicians play themselves. They're all played by actors.
And are they all cool with that?
We'll find out. We'll find out eventually.
So he's talking to fake Calvin Harris.
He's talking to fake Calvin Harris. And at one point, Diplo says something. There was actually a line that Spike Jonze had suggested, which was Diplo turns and is like, are we just posers pressing buttons? And Calvin's response is, no, we're shamanic healers offering glimpses of enlightenment through music. And we play it off as like and the joke is that Diplo's like, are you fucking with me? Or are you like, are we? No, you're fucking with me, right? Are you? Like... and so it lives in that weird kind of awkward gray area, which is where a lot of the show at its best, I feel like, kind of lives. I feel like there is equally some truth to that in some weird way. Like, they really are communicating something that, like you said, can't be communicated with words. It's really only through music. And that's subjective. That's ephemeral.
And you know, the truth of the matter is, like, especially if you're even talking about comedy, there is an approach where you go, well, it's very cathartic for people because you're coming together and it's a defense mechanism, and it creates community and allows people to express things that they may be afraid to express in polite society. It allows them to deal with things, you know. But it's just, so I feel like there's the basic understanding that that's a mechanism at play, but when you say it out loud, it just sounds really silly.
So stupid.
Yeah, exactly. We're healers. Our jokes heal people. And that may actually be the case. And for some people, as a comedy fan, I know that's been the case for me.
Yeah.
But it just sounds really funny when you say it.
When you come right out with it. That's why it was fun to like just layer ridiculousness and stupidity on top of all of these hoity-toity conversations that we had in the writer's room, was just to take the piss out of it, while also really kind of trying to find the truth as much as we could.
It's just I love seeing a passionate subculture about something. And so like when you drive around Los Angeles and you see, like, you know, appearing at this club in Las Vegas, like, who the fuck is that guy? And then you find out, like, well, that's one of the most famous DJs in the world.
In the world.
Who is probably making $50 million a year going. I mean, it's like so to see people really, really like that absorbed and passionate in something, it is contagious, because it's fun to watch people get excited about things.
Yeah. Yeah. That was one of the things that I realized, like, in my early teen idoldom, which is why it was such a mind fuck for me. It was like, I just realized that people really wanted to be passionate about something, and that their people screaming and going crazy and I love you had very little to do with actually me. It was just they wanted to feel passionate about something. And so we were like their excuse. Now, that was a very cynical take to have at 20 years old,
but when you're young and you start discovering your own things that speak your own language and speak to you in a way, and you know, and when that show came out, I remember when the first I remember hearing people my age go, oh my God. And then the one character is like hooking up with the teacher and it's great. It's like when Fast Times came out and you go, oh shit, this is a dialogue that people of a certain age are not privy to, because it is a certain, yeah. It is a certain stratum of communication that is very organic to how it's, you know, this particular generation communicates and wants to be, and it's aspirational in that way. And it's kind of funny. It's like, you know, because Lydia was watching Riverdale, and I go, yeah, it's, you know, they're just, and you don't have to comment on this. I'm like, yeah, they're just doing Dawson's Creek. You know, it's like, with the formula being like, you know, young kids with grown up themes. It's like right. young kids right. playing grown up.
Right. And I'm sure we didn't invent it either. Yeah.
No, but that idea is that it allows people of a certain generation to absorb their, you know, to express their, as they start to get into adulthood, I guess, you know?
Yeah, because like you're going through
doesn't talk down. It's not patronizing. I guess that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's not, and your show in particular was not patronizing in that way. It just like, it was their story. This is the shit they were going through. And, you know, like people of that age were like, fuck, that's so cool that they're going through all these adult problems and shit.
Yeah, they were talking like adults with 30 years of therapy. You know, and I feel like maybe there was some catharsis for teenagers watching it, because it was like, okay, yeah, I was trying to put my finger on it, but now hearing the thing that you know, 40-something-year-old writer wrote crystallizes it in a way that like I wasn't maybe able to express.
Yeah, there was something on Riverdale where I was like, I said the same thing. I was like, 40-year-old writer, but one, I think it's Betty or something, is like, that's so Betty Draper season 2. I'm like, the fucking 40-year-old wrote that. There's not one 16-year-old has ever said that's so Betty Draper season 2. Not even when Mad Men was on. Well, that's all right though.
That's why I love writers, and I love collaborating with writers, because like that's something so specific to that one writer.
Yes.
And it really meant something. And it's like, you know what?
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.